Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick. Visit us at ihatecritics.net, everyonesacriticpodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle is criticspod. Subscribe to us there. Like us there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Alexa, all your podcatchers. Subscribe to the show, write and review the show. We'll read your reviews on the air if we see them. We're also on YouTube. We're streaming live on YouTube right now. If you want to be notified, click on the little bell in the right-hand corner and subscribe to our YouTube channel as well. And we'll try to do better about reading comments and interacting there. Patreon.com/CriticsPod, the best way to help support the podcast. And then our TeePublic page at IHateCritics.net. Get yourself some Everyone's Critic Podcast merch, like this shirt. We've got mugs, all sorts of stuff. So, if you want any of that, ihatecritics.net. There's a link in the right-hand corner for TeePublic. We're going to start with news for the first time in a long time.
there's a couple things.
Yeah. So go ahead and you take over this part of it.
Well, there's just a couple things that are going on Twitter today where people are defending Greta Gerwig mostly off of this article written by somebody in the San Francisco Chronicle for no good reason. I don't know. I think columnists just have such a desperation to come up with things to whine about. and as somebody who has to talk on the radio every day, I understand the challenge. But this is just such a shitty article. It's just being shitty for no good reason. He's basically whining that he doesn't want Hollywood to make movies about the insurrection at what happened on Capitol Hill, which insurrection even sounds like too big a word for what took place. This mini riot, basically, that it's bigger than it is because, I don't know, because we had cameras everywhere. You know, if we had actual footage of what was going on in the 60s, that seemed a lot bigger to me. And I think if we had that kind of footage, we'd have more interesting things to say about what it's like to actually rush the Capitol. But anyway, the point of it is that he's whining about Hollywood directors or who might tackle the insurrection. And then he's asking them to please don't make the movie. And then he does this shitty little description of how he thinks that they direct, and this is your style, and please don't do this with the rioters, and he included in among this like all the biggest name directors and, you know, known for big time blockbusters, and then Greta Gerwig for whatever reason, because, you know, all the Marvel movies that she's made, I guess. Big time blockbusters that she's made over the years.
It is weird to me, though, when I go and look at it, she's not the only small director that's included. I mean, like Sofia Coppola, mm-hmm. Steven. So it's like, why did she get pulled out as the one defended as opposed to like Sofia Coppola or Steven Soderbergh? Or that was what was weird to me. Obviously, Oliver Stone should be included on this list, and definitely not Michael Bay or James Cameron. They would do a terrible job.
The whole thing is shitty, though.
I agree.
The whole thing is really crappy, and just make a movie about, if you're inspired to make a movie, make it, you know, and don't let shitty people tell you what not to make movies about. And whining about this is such a pointless columnist thing to do. I've got nothing else better to do, so I'm just going to be crappy to people and diminish what they do for a living.
And I'll be honest, when it was all happening, I was so busy at work, I hardly knew about it. Yeah. A friend of mine started texting me, and I just saw a couple of pictures, and I started texting you, and I was like, this is like that, what was the name of that movie with Zach Galifianakis and Kristen Wiig?
Oh, Masterminds.
This is like the sequel to that. Not knowing, you know, just out of context, guys dressed goofy and just being redneck idiots. Which is kind of what that movie was. And so to me, I see a comedy here. I mean, I also see it 15, 20 years later. I mean, I don't think it would, you know, I think it would play better that way. But again, do whatever, you know, if you can make a good movie about it. Probably rather see a documentary, but that's just me. What else did you have?
Weird interactions on Twitter. First of all, if you're going to say something shitty about celebrities on Twitter, don't tag them. Just share your opinion. You know, there's no need to tag somebody in your crappy little thing that you're going to do on Twitter. So this kid wrote this thing about, if you're having trouble sleeping, put on Master and Commander. I've never made it past 10 minutes of that movie, at Russell Crowe. And Russell Crowe responded to this kid's tweet. And he was just talking about how it's a great movie, and he, Peter Weir, the cinematography, the music, and he wasn't necessarily nasty toward the kid, just kind of, you know, set him straight about, you know, he feels it very strongly, it's a very good movie. The thing that stands out to me, though, is just that tendency that people have on Twitter, that when you've got something shitty to say, to tag the celebrity that you're doing it. And that really irks me. I don't see the, there's no need for it. It's just, you know, attention grabbing. And even then you know, a lot of people are like, well, they'll never see it or respond, or their people handle their Twitter. They'll never know. You know, you're talking to actual people.
Yeah.
I know you think you're not, but you are talking to a lot of actual people when you do that.
And because they're actual people, I mean, granted, Russell Crowe apparently handled it okay, but you catch him on a bad day, and who knows, you know, you could make him look like a total idiot, and maybe that's what you're looking for, and that just makes you shittier than them. But it's just, most people do check their own Twitter. It's just on their phone. Yeah, they get a lot of notifications, and most of them they probably ignore, but it's still right there, just like you, for, you know, when we have, when we get tagged and stuff, granted it's less by a lot, but you still have the opportunity to see it. And that's,
yeah,
it's, I mean, I can't imagine being female on social media.
Oh my God. Yeah. I can only imagine what that must be
all
like.
All the dick pics and DMs. That's, I mean, I'm not even joking. I mean, it's
right. No, that's why Twitter has the option to close your direct messages specifically for that reason.
Yeah.
Cause men are awful. But you know, it reminded me, though, this Russell Crowe thing reminded me of something that's always bothered me, and it came up recently also on Twitter, not as a trending topic, but just as a topic among a group of critics. Like, one of our fellow critics decided it would be a great idea that when he put out a tweet of his review of a movie, that he would tag the star of the movie, and he was doing it even in negative reviews. And it's like, don't do that. Don't tweet your negative review and include the star of the movie. Like, you want a hashtag, maybe fine, but don't tag the celebrity in your negative review. It's really crappy. And then on top of that, there was another critic who thought it would be great to try and beg celebrities on Twitter to do interviews with him by adding them on Twitter. It's like, that is just so cheap. Don't humiliate yourself. Don't humiliate yourself and them by them having to ignore you or, maybe or whatever. Like, just don't do that. It doesn't make you look good. It makes you look desperate. It makes them look rude when they ignore you. And it's just, I hate it. I hate it so much.
Yeah. I mean, they can find
I've tagged celebrities in my reviews sometimes if they're positive, if it's a positive review, because, you know, who doesn't like hearing nice things about themselves?
And they can find the negative ones on their own. I mean, they probably have Google's alerts on the name of the movie. You know, that's on them. They're trying to find that. They're looking for constructive criticism, whatever. They don't want to see it. They don't have to see it. Yeah, I agree with you. and then there was a trailer for a Nick Cage movie that I feel like he makes this movie every year. We don't always talk about it. We're just looking at his IMDb list, and he's got something about a movie in outer space. He's got a lot of these movies, but this one's called Willy's Wonderland. Is that?
I think that's what it's called. Yeah. Willy's Wonderland. I'm starting to worry that he's become too self-aware now. Like, he's too aware of what people think of him, and now he's leaning into it too much. Because this looks like, I don't know, like Mandy with puppets or something. Like, I'm not, which I'm not opposed to necessarily from that concept, but I'm a little bit concerned just about him getting too much into being aware of what he does or what people seem to might like about him. And I don't know. That always kind of that always kind of puts me off. Well, you know, I prefer them to not be aware of that, and it's more fun when they don't know what we think.
Well, that's I got his IMDb page pulled up here, and if you're on YouTube, you can see it as well. He's doing a Joe Exotic project, which is dumb. I mean, Willy's Wonderland looks fun enough, but it looks like it could be, you know, I want to see it before I sit and say it looks awesome, because there's jujitsu, there's Kill Chain, there's Running with the Devil, Color Out of Space. I've thought about watching this a couple different times because it looks fun, but
yeah,
he's been making this movie every year. I mean, obviously you got Mandy, which is kind of stands above and beyond, but Mom and Dad, Army of One, other movies that are fun. But he just keeps making these movies, and yeah, he's mixing in Spider-Man and Teen Titans and the Croods, I guess, regular movies. But I don't know.
I don't know what Pig is. I'm worried about right. that one.
Yeah. So let's see what it says.
Oh yeah, let's look at what this movie is. A truffle hunter who lives alone in the Oregon wilderness must return to his past in Portland in search of his beloved foraging pig after she is kidnapped.
What has this guy made?
Director Michael Sarnowski is a well-known film editor. Yeah.
Well-known?
Or well, yeah, he's an editor. Most known.
Yeah, so we'll see what comes up.
Done some TV and a couple of shorts, and that's it.
Maybe it's amazing. I mean, we could be wrong. Don't get me wrong. It looks like. I mean, but you're right. It's constantly these movies now, and you know, Mandy is off to the side from these, even though I don't know that Nicolas Cage realizes that. But anyway, let's get on with our show and find our movies to talk about this week. And we'll start with Outside the Wire on Netflix.
Yes, Outside the Wire stars Anthony Mackie and Damson Idris. And man, I hate this movie. I really just did not enjoy this at all. So Idris plays this guy who he's a drone pilot. He gets in trouble for calling in a drone strike against orders and gets a couple people killed, but he saved a bunch of other people, which is good. He gets in trouble and sent to the front lines in the Ukraine, where he's assigned to Anthony Mackie, who's a robot, I guess.
Yes.
he's a robot who looks like Anthony Mackie, and he's going to try and deliver some medicine somewhere. But I'm acting like I don't know. I know what the movie is. I just don't care. I didn't care about this movie at all. The action's not particularly interesting. The story beats are just overblown and overdrawn, and nothing particularly interesting happens in this movie. Idris isn't a bad actor. He's interesting enough as a lead. Anthony Mackie is just far more interesting, and what happens with him isn't nearly as much fun. This movie is just dreary and derivative and entirely forgettable.
I like to read the Wikipedia plot summaries of these sometimes.
All right.
The one they did for this one was amazing, because it possibly has changed since I saw it while I was watching it, but let's see here. Where's the premise at? Oh, I think they got into it and changed it.
Oh no.
Basically, he's describing what happens, and then he just starts tailing off going, and then some more boring shit happens and some more boring. They definitely got in there and changed it. This movie's boring more than anything else for an action movie. It's way too boring for an action movie. That said, you know, all of a sudden when you're supposed to know he's a robot, I'm like, he's a what? And my wife's like, you didn't hear that? I'm like, no, I had zoned out. I mean, there's just. And then at one point she goes, he must be a really terrible actor. And I'm like, who? And she's like, that guy, she doesn't know his name. I'm like, Anthony Mackie? He's actually terrific, generally. But this movie, I mean, he's playing a robot, so that's part of it, I guess. But this movie just sucks. It's so boring. And, you know, we were kind of excited about Netflix having a movie every week, but if this is what it's going to be.
Oof, yeah.
I mean, maybe
this is what we've got, man. Maybe they run. This is not a good start.
No, maybe they run like the theaters do in January. They just throw their shit. But I mean, I don't mind. Yeah. I don't mind that it exists. I'm sure there's an audience for it. This is something my dad might like. I just, it's not as, it's just not fun enough for an action movie for me. And it's, but it's not overly complicated. Or it's, I shouldn't say it. It's not overly complicated in a good way. It's just more complicated in a boring way. And then it just kind of keeps, there's like four or five different endings. You know, they could have ended it a bunch of different times and they just keep going. And I was ready for it to end, you know, pretty early on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And there's a twist. And I didn't care.
Exactly. End it before the twist. End it there. Yeah. It's just kind of a bummer. Anything else on outside the wire?
Nothing really. It's like it's barely a movie. I just really, really did not enjoy it at all. And I usually like Anthony Mackie. His last movie, Synchronic, was really good, and a lot of people didn't get a chance to see that. That stinks because he was really good in that.
And they probably got a chance to see this one. Poor guy. Wow, that's small. Locked Down, HBO Max.
Locked Down is starring Anne Hathaway and Chiwetel Ejiofor as a couple in lockdown together in England. England has a much more strict lockdown than America does, meaning that you actually had to stay in your house for several weeks and we're not allowed to get out very often. Directed by Doug Liman, which I didn't know until after I'd actually watched it, which was kind of cool. Not in a lot of his signatures per se, but some some of his style is in there. And I really, you know, he's not a guy who does lockdown. You kind of expect him to be out and about a lot more. And once the movie does get out of there, it does kind of turn into more of a Doug Liman style movie. But the idea here is that these two are a couple who were about to break up, and then the lockdown happens. COVID hits and everybody is stuck at home, and they've got to share this house while they're also kind of falling apart as a couple and wrapping things up. And I was really impressed by how long they stick with that premise of those two just you know, not finding any common ground. They argue interesting way, where you don't long for them to be together. You're kind of happy these two people are going to go their separate ways eventually. And you don't usually see that. Usually it's supposed to be kind of, they set up these kind of characters to have this sort of charming back and forth, and their problems are relatively easy to resolve. And this isn't so easy. I think there's a good deal of, they cram a lot of history into the first two thirds of this movie that is not, you know, they don't spend a lot of time on it, but enough to kind of establish who these two people are and what the issue is. And I really appreciated that. I really appreciated that Chiwetel Ejiofor has this sort of existential crisis going on that's had this really devastating effect on his marriage. And that was a much more interesting problem than a lot of characters like him would have in a movie like this. And so I liked that. I liked a lot of this movie. And then when it becomes something entirely different in the third act, I didn't mind so much because I didn't necessarily see it coming. And I kind of liked the way this plays out. I thought that was an interesting way to go, and at least it was different enough to make me enjoy this.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty impressive because it starts off as just like a Zoom movie where you're watching them interact with like Ben Stiller and others, you know, fairly mini Kaling people, well-known actors, you know, via Zoom. And that's what a lot of lockdown movies were at one point. Not a lot, but there was enough of them that, you know, TV shows did it. All the late night shows did it. And so you think that's what this movie is going to be. And they do a couple of stuff inside the house. So there's a little bit of it. But for the most part, early on, it's a lot of Zoom type stuff. And then they managed to expand on it. And I just thought it was pretty neat. The way they argued was more real life. Like when you live with someone for that long, it's, you start to know where to tread lightly and where not to tread. And then he has this really weird, like you said, existential crisis going on that he thinks the world's against him. And then he has to choose the words carefully, and the way they argue is just like a real married couple, especially one that is probably on the way out, but they can't get rid of each other. And that premise early on, I was kind of like, well, because they do show people cheating during the lockdown, and granted, they're probably in America, but still. And because I'm in America, I'm just like, well, they don't have to follow the rules, but you accept that, and that's kind of the only real thing that had me questioning it. But other than that, this is a lot of just really well done. I thought I was pretty impressed. Still Anne Hathaway smoking. She's got to stop smoking in movies because it doesn't look real. This is like three in a row or maybe more where she clearly doesn't smoke in real life. And it's like she's a terrific actress. And this, her hand is just not up to par with the rest of her body.
I've never noticed. Cause I don't smoke. So I
don't
no
either,
idea.
But this is the third time. I mean, we've talked about it like on for three different movies now. I think the one she did with Matthew McConaughey, you had mentioned it, and then she did one later on.
Oh, yeah, okay, yes. Now I remember.
And then
yeah,
there was one after that I saw and I mentioned.
I think I was just so happy with this movie that I didn't really notice it.
But yeah, if you got HBO, definitely check this out. It's unique. It's kind of a cool movie that's pretty original, which is pretty cool. Anything else on lockdown?
Just like I said, I was surprised that this was a Doug Liman movie, and good for him for finding something that is kind of against type for a director to be locked in one spot and to have to come up with what he did was really good. It's really clever.
And the way they went with it, too. Most movies don't go that way and have you, go along with it. So I thought that was pretty impressive, too. I don't want to spoil anything. Mm-hmm. But yeah. Now let's move on to the star this week, One Night in Miami.
One Night in Miami was directed by Regina King, and it stars Kingsley Benadir as Malcolm X, Eli Gorey as Muhammad Ali, Aldis Hodge as Jim Brown, and Leslie Odom Jr. from Hamilton as Sam Cooke. And man, what a great choice that is. Such an amazing thing. One Night in Miami is based off the premise of a meeting in 1963 between these four well-known black icons in this one Miami hotel. They've gathered together after Muhammad Ali's huge victory. They're getting together at Malcolm X's hotel room, and he's going to tell them of something very important about what he's decided to do with the Nation of Islam. Meanwhile, Muhammad Ali's about to say that he's joining the Nation of Islam, and Jim Brown's got a big life-changing decision about his retirement coming up. And there's this so many exciting things happening in this movie, and the exciting interactions and the shifting of what's important and what's not important is really incredibly well done. This is based off of a stage play, and there's a certain staginess to it, but it doesn't really come through too much. The actors aren't overdoing anything, and that really helps. Man, this movie is just so damn impressive, and for Regina King to do this as a first-time director, I mean, obviously, I think she's given herself less of a visual challenge because it's set mostly in just one spot, which I think is a smart play for any first-time director. It's just confined basically to this one room, and it's just these shifting interactions between these four very big personalities, and that is really an effective way to tell this story. And if with these big personalities, extraordinarily well portrayed as they are, it becomes exciting just watching this interaction and just listening to them talk, especially the middle section of Malcolm X and Sam King just arguing back, or Sam Cooke arguing back and forth about what's important and what's not important, and who's doing more for their community, who's doing damage with what they do. It's exciting to listen to, and everybody's got a really good point and a strong point of view, and that gives life to just to everything that happens in this movie.
Yeah, and I mean, in a lot of ways, this is a must see. I thought you're right about the way, you know, the direction, but I think you having an actor direct a movie like this is great because it's all about the performances and it's not about anything else. And she knows that. And because of that, she's able to, you know, take a lot of distractions out of this movie and just make it about the performances on top of the fact that they're acting as, you know, four well-known people. It was just really impressive. I thought I just was engrossed the whole movie. I mean, just kind of sitting there watching. I don't really, cause I try not to sit here and bring my opinion to movies like this. Cause I don't have to deal with any of it. Cause I'm a white guy.
Yeah.
So I don't want to have an opinion. I just want to sit here and listen and learn about other people's experiences that I'll never have to deal with. And then, you know, accept them for what they are and not try to attack the Capitol building or whatever. So
I got to highlight a couple of things. There's a scene between Aldous Hodge and Beau Bridges that is incredible. You've got him visiting this white liberal in Georgia having this conversation, and Beau Bridges' character is all really kind and, you know, just being so nice to him and how proud of him he is and how much pride he has in this guy being Jim Brown, being from their hometown. It's really all this great stuff. And then the scene ends when his wife or daughter or somebody comes out to him and says, you know, we need to move this piece of furniture in the house. You promised you would. And Beau Bridges gets up to go do it. And Jim Brown offers to help. And he goes, oh no, Jim, we don't allow in the house. And it's like, wow, just this gut punch is like of the end of the scene is just such a, man.
Yeah.
It's so awful. It's so awful. And you're just, it drives the point of the entire, you know, film home in one moment.
Well, all
you can,
four of
you
them.
Can achieve anything. Yeah. Yeah.
All four of them have a moment like that at the beginning of this movie. But that one is very, very strong. The Sam Cooke one too, where he has to perform for, I don't know. I just, was there any, you were going to highlight some other points? Or other scenes?
Yeah, Eli Gorey as Muhammad Ali. The way he captures the youthfulness of Muhammad Ali, like combination of his youth and his bravery, kind of exceeding his own intelligence even at that time, is so amazing and just what a performance. He still embodies Ali, and yet at the same time we know Ali is as so much more of an icon now, and he captures just how young he was and being reminded of how young Ali was at the time when he made this huge life-changing decision really does, it gives you so much perspective, so much more perspective on him and just how incredible he truly was.
And to not be a distraction in the movie too, because that's a voice of all of them, we know his voice the most,
right?
Because he's the most famous of the four of them. But nobody stands above the rest. You know, these are four equal guys interacting, and it would be very easy to take the Muhammad Ali character, or even the Malcolm X character for that matter, and put them, you know, make them a distraction in this movie. And Regina King and the actors do a great job of keeping them all equal and just allowing for the conversation to happen, which I just love movies like this that are interesting and it's all about dialogue in one room.
And there again, you know, with Kingsley Benadire as Malcolm X, we know him as this powerful orator, and this, you know, he's got an aura to him authority to him, and he finds he goes immediately to find the vulnerability of Malcolm X that is not part of the, you know, the legend of Malcolm X. We don't know him as this figure of vulnerability, and he finds that very well and incorporates that into every other aspect that we do know of Malcolm X. And that's again another really incredibly smart play. And then Leslie Odom Sam Cooke. It's so smart the way that they're playing that. You're talking about all the money that he made. I love that story that he tells about the Rolling Stones and how he, you know, his artist who created the song was somebody who was just really upset to see this, you know, that this other band took his song and made it theirs, and then he shows him that he's number one and that the songwriter gets paid for that. And I was like, oh, that is really great. That's a great story. But Malcolm X has a point too. It's like, why aren't you doing something that's more meaningful? You know, something that's actually part of the cause instead of continuously, you know, making white people happy. That back and forth is incredible.
Yeah, that scene where he plays "Dust in the Wind" or "Blowing in the Wind," whatever that.
"Blowing in the Wind."
That's a phenomenal scene too. but they're all right. You know, none of them are, everybody's perspective is accurate and productive. And, you know, there's nobody who's wrong in this thing, you know? And then you throw in the fact that, you know, I kind of mentioned Muhammad Ali not being a star, but in real life, all these guys were huge characters to the public, but then at some point they had to not be on, you know, they had to, you know, step down and be human beings. And that's another fun thing to see is, like you mentioned, them finding the vulnerability of Malcolm X. These guys are coming down and now they're just acquaintances or peers in a hotel room talking, and they're not, he don't have to be on, they don't have to be Muhammad Ali, he doesn't have to be Jim Brown. And I the way they captured that is really impressive too. And I'm sure the play plays a big role in how all this works out, but I just found, and I've never seen it, so I can't judge, but I just, that whole, the idea of all that is just so great. It's so believable, you know, knowing who all these guys are and then seeing them as human beings, aside from the popular, persona that they have, is very believable that they would be like this. So I just all around impressed. I really love this movie. And if this is count towards 2020, probably would have been right there. I don't know. All right, let's move on to the next movie, MLK and the FBI.
Yes, it's directed by Sam Pollard, who I had the privilege of having a conversation with. It's going to be on my radio show tomorrow, and I'll share that on all the social medias so people can hear that. But MLK FBI tells the story of the FBI's COINTELPRO. They're programmed to undermine Martin Luther King by any means necessary, including the most illegal means they could come up with. And it was entirely illegal what they did to him. He didn't commit any crimes, and they set about, you know, recording every aspect of his life that they could and trying to use that against him. This movie is engrossing. The way that Sam Pollard puts this all together, he's a well-known editor who's worked with Spike Lee for a number of years. He actually did the editing on Four Little Girls, another incredible documentary about this similar kind of story. The way he does this is with a series of simple, you know, editing, you know, interviews that you do typically for a documentary you do on camera. He does them just with audio and continues to just show you the image of Martin Luther King in various different forms, or the FBI, the various ways that the FBI have been presented over the years and how vaunted and how respected the FBI was in that time. I mean, even people who knew that what the FBI was doing to Martin Luther King still respected the FBI. And that's kind of a ridiculous thing because they were committing horrific crimes against this man and against so many people like Martin Luther King. We're going to talk about a movie in a couple of weeks called Judas and the Black Messiah, which is an amazing film. I can't wait to talk about it. But a similar idea that the FBI was trying to take down black leaders, whatever they needed to do by any means necessary. And that film is about Fred Hampton. This movie is about Martin Luther King. And it all comes back to the just horrific racism at the heart of J. Edgar Hoover, who was just an outright evil racist. And a lot of it had to do with communism too. I get that. And that's a big part of this movie as well, is talking about how they felt that black people are more susceptible to to communist thoughts, and they can be corrupted with communism and so on. As if being kind to people is some kind of virus that more people are susceptible to. That's just ludicrous. But the whole thing with Hoover was he was concerned about the rise of a black messiah. And of course, that's he first coined that phrase talking about Martin Luther King. But it moves on, you know, by that when King dies, it passes over to a number of different people, like Fred Hampton becomes one who's, you know, a rising star in the Black Panthers. And he becomes the next black messiah. And we need to stop him. And they do, by outright killing him. This movie is powerful, and it's something that everybody needs to see and understand that this is wrong. And, you know, if you ever wonder why we put handcuffs on our intelligence services and try and keep some handcuffs on our police, even this is why, because unchecked, you know, power is going to delve into abuse. And that's what they did. The FBI's power was unstopped by anybody, and they just did whatever they wanted to do regardless of the law.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I'll just go another route that you haven't covered, because everything you said was right on. The history books, this really does a good job of, I shouldn't even say this does a good job, but it was just neat for, here's what I grew up learning versus here's what was actually happening during that time. You know, mm-hmm. We don't necessarily learn that Hoover's a horrible person. You know, we just know he was the head of the FBI when we were kids. That's what we're learning in the history school or history class. Now you're hearing, you know, you're getting to see more of what it was actually like there by having this documentary out there, things like that. And I look at today and everything that was going on right now and what the history books are going to actually say. And it's like, you know, it's going to be watered down, and maybe not as much because of all the social media and the cameras, like you mentioned earlier in the podcast, but it's going to be, you know, the victors are going to get to tell how the history went. And it's not going to be, we're not going to be as divided. It's not going to appear that way when the history books are finally written 30, 40 years from now, as we are right now. And I found that part of this whole thing fascinating. You know, then you throw in the communist part, how paranoid they were over that, mixed in with, you know, the fact that he was a horrible racist. And I mean, growing up, I learned that Malcolm X was bad and Martin Luther King Jr. was great. You know, Malcolm X wanted violence, and it's just, and I grew up in a small town in Illinois, right, that was very white. That watch and watching One Night in Miami all just had me kind of doing a lot of just remembering about being a kid and what you like. Even I remember someone telling me Jim Brown was horrible because of the way he, you know, what he stood for. But Jim Brown was long retired before I was born, so I didn't really, I knew who he was based on more as an actor than anything. So it's just kind of fascinating how what the history book said and then what really happened. And back to One Night in Miami, Martin Luther King was a personality. What was he like behind closed doors? You know, not that I want to know that and we deserve to know that, but there is stuff you can learn from that. And that's a good thing. He's a human being. He's not perfect. He was also very young, which seems so weird. It's weird that I'm.
Yeah, know. That is because when you look at him in speeches, you think he's somewhere in his 50s. And I think part of that is because of Hoover. I think he stressed him out so desperately that I think Martin Luther King actually does seem like he ages just because of all the stress that he must be under just from the constant surveillance from the FBI.
And I don't know if it's social media, but I don't feel like I'm growing up. So as I'm getting older and I'm looking back at history, and it's like all of a sudden these guys are actually younger than me, but they seem so much more mature and so much more powerful. Yeah. It's just, you know, when you humanize this stuff, it actually makes it more impressive than it was. And I don't want to know. I guess there's more coming out in 2027 with the FBI. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's not what matters is that it was wrong. It was illegal, and it shouldn't have happened. And this, documentary will definitely frustrate you. And then you find out the political, I mean, you don't find out, you know, but right. anything that people make when they make decisions based on politics, it is insanely frustrating. You know, that's why everybody hates, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell and Leslie Graham and Schumer and all these guys. They hate all of them because they all, none of them seem to act based on what they really want to do. They act based on their party strategy, and that's and
yeah,
but this movie captures some of that too with, you know, Lyndon B. Johnson and, you know, even the Kennedys to an extent. And it's just, I don't know, it's a powerful movie. It's infuriating throughout, and right. but also you learn a lot, and I don't know, it's another must see.
Incredibly well made. And, you know, Sam Pollard said something interesting because I told him that I don't want those tapes to come out. Like, I don't think we ever need to hear any of that. And he goes, well, actually, you know, those tapes, they're not all tapes of people having sex, which is what people assume is that the thing that they're holding back are these tapes where they recorded Martin Luther King having sex outside of his marriage, which it's an audio tape. First of all, how would right. you even know? But second of all, he points out that not everything that they recorded was sexual. You can actually hear like Martin Luther King and the kind of strategy that he was making back in that time. And he kind of intimated in his own mind, not necessarily a conspiracy theory, but just the thought that perhaps the reason why these tapes have been sealed for so long isn't because anybody's trying to protect Martin Luther King, but rather that on these tapes could be the strategy for a revolution that almost happened and could inspire new revolution today. And that's the kind of thing that kind of got me excited. Like okay, now I'm really interested. Now I want to know what's on these tapes.
Well, yeah, just the idea of audio, you know, sexual encounters. I mean, that's part, I mean, they mentioned that in the documentary, how they tried to convince his wife that he was cheating on her, and she didn't know it was him. She just heard two people. So she goes, what is this supposed to mean? And was more frustrated or annoyed by the fact that they were reaching out to her, trying to, you know, expose him. I don't know. It's the whole thing's, for lack of a better word, fascinating, but in a wide variety of emotions. I liked what I learned, you know, that's what I like most about it, but it is infuriating at times or throughout most of it. And yeah, it's a must see. And I mean, I just finished Obama's book, which he's pretty goes in deep on certain things, but it's really neat how he kind of gives you as a human being, what he wants to do as a politician and then what actually happened. And But he digs in deep. And if you're not interested in what he's talking about in that point in the time, the book kind of drags. But when you are interested, it's very, very fascinating.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I've just been in this political mindset lately, especially with how can you not be if you live in America? I just found it fascinating, you know, watching this and how relevant it is to today.
Yeah, question what you've learned and what people tell you and why they're telling you that. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't hear about these black leaders of the 70s. You hear about the violence. That's what you hear. And nobody bothers to ask why anybody wanted to be violent. And we're brought up not asking the question. Like, we're just told, you know, the violence is bad and not why. Why was there calls for violence and what was the meaning behind them? You know, why was Martin Luther King calling for a revolution? You do kind of hear some of that, but you don't hear enough of it. And he was never violent. He was always going to be, you know, peaceable change, but why was it necessary what he did? And why did so many people feel the need to try and stop him from doing it?
Right. But yeah, this should be seen by in every history class from here on out, as far as I'm concerned. All right. How do you transition out of this?
Found footage horror.
The Curse of Aurora. Is that how it's pronounced?
Aurora.
Aurora.
Yes. The Curse of Aurora. is a found footage horror movie set in Canada. A group of people who travel to Canada to a neighborhood where a real life murder occurred. A young girl was murdered by her family, and her spirit is supposedly still around and still haunting people. And forgive me, it's been a little while since I've seen this movie, so I'm trying to recall it. The thing about this is that separates it, I guess, a little bit from other found footage horror movies, for me anyway, is that the basis of this is that the star Lana Baron actually does own a home in this. She actually owns the home that we see in the movie. It's actually in the neighborhood where this supposed curse of Aurora exists. And the idea for the film is entirely based upon her and the director and one of the producers getting together at her house and talking about the kind of movie that they can make. And this whole meta narrative is basically, they just said, hey, why don't we make that the movie? And then they found these two actors and Lana Baron herself who are very interesting people, who are charismatic enough and who are able to carry this action and make it interesting. And so I liked these characters and I liked their interactions throughout. And I enjoyed the scenes that built up to this shocking ending. I thought it was very interesting. And I see way too many found footage horror movies. I've seen way too many. And I'm pretty well bored by the concept, but I like these people enough that I didn't mind it as much for this movie. And for that, I mean, just overcoming, you know, the typicalities of this overworked genre, that worked for me.
Yeah. I mean, I can't disagree with that. You want it to beat Blair Witch and it can't. No. So that's not fair. You know, Paranormal Activity goes off on its own little thing, which is a little more original than this, but that got beat to the ground to death. But outside of those two, and I probably like this better than Paranormal Activity, but I think that one's a little bit more original than this. This definitely stands above the rest in terms of the more recent horror found footage horror movies.
There isn't really much to say. I mean, it does shaky cam, and it does, you know, the supernatural stuff at the end, but I liked the way that they built it. I thought there's a scene in about, I don't know, midway through the movie where they're just hanging out, walking around this town, and they decide to just lay down in the middle of the street. Yeah. And it's a fun scene, and it's got some tension to it, and it builds to an exciting conclusion. And I enjoyed that. They seem to approach each scene like it's own mini play. And I enjoyed that aspect of it. So liking these characters is enough, I guess, for me to like this movie, because so often the characters in these found footage movies are just so forgettable. And they're just chum for the water, you know, and it's just, ugh.
I agree completely, and I was actually pretty into it up until the end, and that's when I started. I mean, it's a good ending for a horror movie, but at that point you're either go with it or you don't, and I was starting to check out at that point. But you're right, that scene where they're laying down on the road, that could have gone a million different ways, and because of that, all of them would have been believable ways, and the tension there is fantastic. You're right. It's the characters really do make this kind of stand above most. But yeah, it's available if you want to see it. And I did like the part where they were cutting Matt in his stomach, and he was like, "No, keep rolling, keep rolling."
That was good.
The Rock Camp commercial.
Yeah, that's basically what this is. It's a commercial for Rock Camp. I mean, it's a nearly 90-minute supposed documentary that doesn't really reveal anything. Not really anything at all. You meet the guy who created Rock Camp, and then you see a bunch of rock stars and a few of the average folks who get to meet them and play alongside them, and you get not much of the actual experience of what Rock Camp might actually be like, which, you know, you kind of, if you wanted some insight into how these people interact with these people and maybe teach them something. You're not going to really find that here. You're going to find some heartwarming stories, a couple of special needs kids who are there, who attend. And opening and closing by Alice Cooper. That's probably the most interesting thing in the movie. And then that's about it.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to see this. I was really excited about it. And it basically is like a late night commercial if they were going to do something like that for a fantasy camp. They do a fairly decent job of not making you annoy that these are just all a bunch of rich guys going to fantasy camp. I mean, early on you start to think that, then they get you distracted. But that, I mean, really, that's what's happening here is just a bunch of people who have a lot of money. You get to go to this who didn't quite make it. You know, as someone who can play guitar, it's something I would never do. I would be too intimidated by it. And to me, that, and they go down that road about how, you know, they're all intimidated, blah, blah, blah. But they don't go down it enough to make me want to go. I've talked to like everybody in this movie, which was other than like the guys from Kiss. I was kind of shocked at, I was like, even like Tony Franklin, the bass player, he was on my other podcast and I lost that interview before I posted it.
Oh, no.
I felt so bad.
He's such a good guy too. He's like he's like the nicest guy in the movie.
Yeah. In the end, it's just a commercial. I would have rather they followed like the drummer or the kid with autism who was a fantastic guitar player. I didn't care about the dad with the kid with a brain damage, until he got to that point and it was all about him. And he clearly was just some loser rich guy who, you know, his fucking dishwasher is like a Marshall amp, stickers all over. I mean, if my wife would let me do stupid stuff, I'd probably like, this is, I have to take this down every week because this is our office. That's what, so it's it's up for the YouTube. That's it. I don't know. So much of it was just kind of, there was a lot of waste time. I would have loved to see that drummer story though, because he had some interesting stuff. He was a fantastic drummer. He could have been in Lenny Kravitz, but then he did something else. And then, yeah. I believe every word he said, because he was amazing. The kid with autism was a guitar player, was awesome. But I would have rather just had pick one of them or maybe two of them and run the whole movie about their experiences. And, you know, that's it. And I think it would have been a decent documentary. Instead, it's just a commercial. There's nothing wrong with it. It would be an entertaining commercial, but that's about all it is.
Yeah, and there's just nothing. If you were paying to see this...
I paid $12 to see this.
Sorry about that.
Well, no, I wanted to see it. I could have not watched it. I thought part of it was, too, was, you know, I wanted to see how many people I'd interviewed. And he had some of my favorite, like Joe Perry is my favorite guitar player. Zach Wilde's right there. Nancy Wilson, I love her. Sammy Hagar is probably the biggest person I've ever interviewed. All those people are in it. And it was great to see them. But it is what Alice Cooper was fun. And the guy who runs it's interesting. You could have done it about him maybe, but even that's just another rich white guy doing stuff. So
yeah. That's pretty much all the impression that it ever made on me. And it's not particularly stylistically interesting. It's a lot of walking into different rooms where people are, you know, you're following a rock star into a room where people are playing and people are like, oh, is that, it's him. What do I do? Just keep playing.
And look, it's cool that you get to play a bunch of Kiss songs with Paul Stanley, or you get to play a Megadeth song with Dave Mustaine or whatever. That's neat, but they don't do enough to capture all that to really, you know, I have to bring a lot of that, how cool it'd be for me in that scene. You know, the movie doesn't bring it out of you, if that makes sense. You have to kind of bring it to it. So, if you ever want to watch the commercial,
I would honestly rather watch one of the what do they call them? They call them master classes.
Yeah.
I'd rather watch the master class like as a documentary as opposed to this documentary. You imagine like a master class with like a really great guitarist like teaching people, you know, things about playing guitar or just telling stories about being a rock star. That'd be far more interesting than this movie.
There's like 15 to 20 movies within here that had you take those scenes and just turn it into a movie, that would have been more interesting than this whole... They tried to cram too much, and then you missed all the substance. And now you're 100% right. But yeah, Rock Camp. It's, I think, available now at... I don't know what theater I rented it from. But don't waste your time. It'll be free someday. Love, Sarah.
Love, Sarah. Yes, Love, Sarah is a... yeah, the interesting thing about this movie is that the first 3 minutes are really, really great. And it's just this montage that sets up the entire universe of this movie, which is, it's exceptionally well done. This woman, Sarah, is on a bicycle riding to her new bakery that she's just bought with her best friend, Shelley Kahn. And we see her riding her bike, and she's getting phone messages. She's not answering, obviously, because she's riding a bike. And we're hearing her phone messages from her friend, played by Shelley Kahn, who's waiting for her at their new bakery location. You see her daughter call her. She's a ballet dancer. She's at ballet practice. You see her mother, Celia Emery, who she's estranged from. You see that just because the mother is writing her a letter, and we see kind of a snatch of the letter that talks about how they're estranged from each other. And really, in 3 minutes, they set up the entire universe of this movie and what's going on here. And as it turns toward what's about to happen, the tragedy that kind of is the inciting incident for the rest of the movie, they just turn just this ever so slightly with the music getting a little bit darker, and then just some clever visual shorthand of sirens in the distant. In the distance, and Sarah's bicycle, and you know what happened, and you're only 3 minutes into this movie, and you've already established an entire universe, and that's really awesome, like really fantastic shorthand filmmaking. It's a terrific short film. Then you've got to sit there for the rest of it, and it's like, I compared it to, it's basically like the adult contemporary of movies. It's all very professional and all very, you know, well produced, and you just don't care. It's like, this is the I just don't care. Like, it's fine. It's the kind of movie that you can put on in the background at your grandmother's house, and she won't even notice that it ended, and she's not going to go back and finish watching it. She's just going to be there for noise that's happening. I said in my written review that, you know, I ignore Celine Dion in the grocery store. I don't go to see her play live. That's kind of what this movie is like.
That's funny. Yeah, I didn't see it. I think this one too was in theaters, and you had to rent via theater.
Like that. I don't know. Really, honestly.
Yeah, I was excited for a second, and then. Sounds like you're excited for 3 minutes. Got boring.
Yeah, it just becomes incredibly, incredibly bland and forgettable. Like, I was trying, I had to read my review right before the show to remind myself of what took place.
Well, that was the thing when I'd mentioned, you were like, oh yeah, I forgot we're going to talk about Love, Sarah. I forgot about that movie. And then you start this review out like, maybe you rewatched it. You seem pretty into it. All right, let's move on to our classic.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed classic.
Notting Hill.
Notting Hill, 1999, directed by Roger Mitchell and starring Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant, and tells the story of a movie star falling in love with an average person who happens to be Hugh Grant, but still an average Englishman who runs a travel bookstore in the neighborhood of Notting Hill, where the movie Love, Sarah is also set in Notting Hill. This movie is really clever, and the clever thing is just everything about Julia Roberts being Julia Roberts and Hugh Grant being Hugh Grant. I mean, you're talking about two incredible movie stars at the height of their power, you know, doing what they do. And that's really impressive and fun to watch. These two have ridiculous chemistry, and watching them together is exciting in that kind of way that a great romantic comedy is exciting. Roger Mitchell also directs it with a great pace, and it's brisk, it's breezy, it's got complications that make sense, and characters who are making motivated decisions that aren't forced by the plot. And I find myself just finding this, I can watch this movie so easily. And so it's just so very, very watchable and easy to watch and easy to enjoy. And Julia Roberts, I think here is where, honestly, this is the best Julia Roberts. Forget your
Pretty Woman
garbage, and all the nonsense movies she's made over the years. This is the Julia Roberts that is her at her best, that really captures the Julia Roberts that I want to see in a movie. She's so good here, and I know she's playing a kind of a outsized version of herself in many ways because she's playing a big Hollywood actress, but I think she finds the soul of the character so beautifully. And that bit where they're talking in bed about you go to bed with the fantasy and you wake up with the reality. I love that. She delivers that so beautifully with so much depth and emotion. And the little joke wrap up at the end is cute. Everything about this movie works for me.
I mean, it doesn't not work. I mean, when we play Flickchart and this keeps, especially when Josh is on, and this would beat like good movies, and I'm just like, really? And then I watch it, I'm like, okay. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a romantic comedy. Right. It's a movie. I mean, I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I guess it would be more zoned back a little bit. I'm not as it exists, it's fine, there's nothing wrong with it, but it's just a romantic comedy. Maybe it's a little bit better than most, but it's still just another, I mean, I don't know, we gave Josh a hard time for loving Predator so much. It's kind of like, this is what Predator is to action movies, I guess. I don't know, it's
this is the greatest romantic comedy of all time.
Well, you're not saying that, but I can see Josh sitting here saying that maybe that was what was that movie that he likes so much? Serendipity or something like Serendipity. That. I mean, maybe this is better than that, I guess. But
I would say so.
I'll agree with that. But I mean, it's fine, but it's just kind of your above average romantic comedy. I mean, it's not Annie Hall. It's not Chasing Amy. You know, it's. I don't know, the next level down, I suppose. You can call it a classic. Everybody's fine in it. I mean, you got the two perfect actors for this movie. I feel like they've been in 7 or 8 other movies, but maybe not. Maybe it's just this one over and over.
Well, they might have done another movie together. I don't remember.
I had just seen The Undoing. Watched that with Hugh Grant, where he does not play a likable guy at all.
Yeah.
Is that
any good? I don't...
I mean, it's good, but it's not like changed again. It's as good for TV shows as this is for movies. So, I mean, Nicole Kidman's, even when the movie is not always great, she's good. And Hugh Grant's usually pretty good. And I mean, they do a good job of making you wonder what's going to happen, but because of it's a television show, they draw it out a lot longer. And because you have to wait a week to find out what happens, you kind of forget about potential plot holes. So just like all TV shows, they do a good job of that. So when they switch on a dime, you don't really notice. You're not there to go, wait a second, that doesn't make sense. So if that exists in The Undoing, I couldn't tell you because I had to watch it over a stretch of time. But I mean, there's nothing wrong with this movie. I'm not the demographic for it. So I'm going to. Like, I'm going to lean Heat every time.
And I will take this over Heat.
And yeah. So, I mean, it's that kind of, it's just more of what I'm into versus good or bad, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And I finally found out what movie that I'm just a girl talking to whatever. Like, it's from this. I've known that line forever. Now I know the movie it's from. And I don't think any of us watched anything from 1991, right?
No, everything cost like a couple bucks, and nothing of here looks interesting enough to purchase. Although I kind of wanted to see this just because it looks so goofy. Like, I think he's fighting Gregory Hines fighting a robot woman. Sounds interesting, but I didn't want to pay $3 for it.
Yeah, the Eva Destruction. It looks like this is not the original poster. Maybe it is, but it looks like they sell a Silence of the Lambs poster and kind of try to make it look like that, which comes out later this in 1991.
Yeah.
Flight of the Intruder. I'll never forget this poster from the video store that I never watched. All-star cast.
Looks like Iron Eagle.
Right. Willem Dafoe is such an odd actor. Like, he's been as good as it can get, and then does this and Body of Evidence and weird shit like
that. Yeah, but I mean, look at that. Danny Glover, Willem Dafoe, Brad Johnson.
Who is Brad Johnson?
I don't know who Brad Johnson is.
Like, I was expecting.
But at one point in his life, Brad Johnson earned the right to have his name right next to Willem Dafoe and Danny Glover.
I think they should have just put Tom Berenger in there. That'd have made more sense.
At least Tom Berenger's real name is Brad Johnson.
Honest to God, I went to look down to see who was the guy in the middle, and I was expecting to see his name. Instead, I see Brad Johnson. I'm like, the quarterback? Yeah, I never watched this movie, but I saw it always sitting on the shelf in the video store. So
the only thing they can count on is each other.
Backdraft.
What about America? They can count on America.
Men of Respect. I don't even know.
Looks like a generic gangster movie. I don't know.
Yeah, if it was made by the Coen brothers, I would have watched it. Once Around, this looks awful.
I watched some clips of it on YouTube, and yeah, it's pretty bad. Holly Hunter starts dating an older man played by Richard Dreyfuss, and her father is Danny Aiello. And Richard Dreyfuss is actually only 43 years old in this picture. I kid you not. In this picture right there, he's 43 years old.
How old are you?
44.
Wow.
They made adults back in the day.
That was neat. One of the neat things in the Rock Camp documentary was when Alice Cooper was talking about being on a plane, and he's like 70 years old, and there's this guy who looks older than he is, who's only 50, because he works a normal job, and Alice Cooper's literally 20 years older than this guy. And don't pretend like Alice Cooper looks young by any means. He dresses young and has long hair, but he doesn't look, you know, Steven Tyler, Sammy Hagar, these guys don't look 70, you know, compared to like Bill Clinton and people who are actually 70. But that's crazy. What happened? Are we just not getting mature? I mean, is that what it is?
Some people kind of just age a little bit more, maybe. I don't know.
I just want to. Yeah, I don't know.
Richard Dreyfuss really lived, apparently.
No kidding. How old was Holly Hunter?
33.
Well, I guess still 10 years older, but geez, he looks 50. 50s. Like mid 50s.
Yeah.
How old's Danny Aiello?
He's actually in this, he's 60.
He looks younger than Richard Dreyfuss in this picture.
Yeah, this movie is not available. It's not on any type of streaming service. It's not on Blu-ray and DVD. It's just there are just various clips on YouTube. That's it.
Yeah, so those who listen to the podcast, you really want to watch our YouTube channel where you can see what we're looking at. And then there's White Fang, which, sorry. Is this not on Disney Plus?
It is on Disney Plus, actually.
I didn't even think about that till right now. Anyway, I wouldn't have watched it no matter what.
Right.
This looks boring as hell. I mean, the book was boring. But yeah.
So we failed. We failed our 30 years. It's true. We failed it.
It's January. We have time. Let me get Flick Chart ready. We haven't done that in a while.
I didn't even bother to check what comes out 30 years ago next week.
Only one movie. Only really? One movie.
Is there one?
Directed by Robert Downey Sr.
Oh.
Too Much Sun.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Well, we'll see. I think that's on Tubi for free, actually.
Really? That's cool. All right. Oh, Jesus
Christ. Come on. What? You set that up.
I honestly just pulled it up now.
There's no way.
I wish I could set it up. Kingpin, Notting Hill. Or before we get to Flickchart, that is our show. Next week, we've got at least Our Friend and Brothers by Blood. There's a few other. There's a Netflix movie. There's a Hulu movie. We'll see what we get to. The classic's going to be Love Story. And like we said, 1991, Too Much Sun, directed by Robert Downey Sr., starring Robert Downey Jr. Flickchart.com/podcast. Critics Pod, Best Foot Up Sports Podcast, and then TeePublic.
Flickchart.com?
Yeah, Flickchart. Go there. Patreon.com/CriticsPod. This Best Foot Up Sports Podcast. Flickchart.com is where you go for fun. And then our TeePublic page at IHateCritics.net. If you click on the right-hand corner, there's a little link to TeePublic. Or if you search...
We're not in any way affiliated with Flickchart, nor do they agree with anything we say.
No.
For legal purposes.
Because we keep picking Notting Hill over other movies. Notting Hill, Kingpin. First time.
Recency bias, Notting Hill.
God damn it. Let's see what happens here.
Flip the coin.
God, you always win the coin flip. Grumpy old men, 40-year-old virgin.
40-year-old virgin.
Agreed. Lord of the Rings, The Two Tower, Vim Verger, and Vitaliki.
I'm not sure I've seen Popeye's 30s cartoons.
Ninja Turtles, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers.
it's Ninja Turtles.
Why couldn't Josh be here for this one? Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, Anger Management.
Oh, Mission Impossible.
Flip the coin. God, motherfucking damn it. You won again. 21 Jump Street, Aliens.
21 Jump Street.
Feel bad, but I agree. The Karate Kid, Murder on a Honeymoon.
I haven't seen Murder on a Honeymoon.
Neither have I. Who? Karate Kid, Chasing Amy.
Chasing Amy.
Agree, but it hurts. Babies, Scream 2.
I've seen Babies.
You have? All right, I haven't, but you can...
Yeah, let's put up Scream 2 against something else.
The Simpsons movie, Scream 2. Oh,
Simpsons movie I would pick.
Yeah, me too. Pet Sematary, fuck that guy.
Yeah, definitely.
Crystal Island, No Pain, we're not gonna... does that count as a movie? Emmanuel in America? I've never watched any of them, but I mean, I know what they are.
I've only seen the original, I think.
To make it
no, wait, I did. No, I saw her in space. I saw Emmanuel in space once.
Pet Sematary, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Agreed. The Sound of Music, If?
Not seen If. Intriguing, though.
Ooh, Sound of Music, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
It's Sound of Music for me.
I really like that Spider-Man movie, though. I'll flip it again. You're going to win, so it doesn't matter. Oop, I won for a change. Huh. Shaun of the Dead, RoboCop 2.
Shaun of the Dead.
Agreed. Space Jam, Ronin.
Space Jam.
Yes. Nacho Libre, Whiplash.
Whiplash.
Agreed. Ghost Rider, Freddy versus Jason.
Freddy versus Jason.
12 Monkeys, Eraser.
12 Monkeys.
From Dusk Till Dawn, Revenge of the Nerds.
I don't like either one. Revenge of the Nerds.
I'll go From Dusk Till Dawn, but I'm not passionate about that one either.
Yeah, I don't think either one's very good.
You win. The Thing, Robin Hood.
The Thing. Robin Hood with Russell Crowe, by the way.
Right. Muppets.
That's not a movie. I don't think Muppets at Disney World's a movie.
A Fistful of Dollars, Legends of the Fall.
Fistful of Dollars.
Agreed. Fistful of Dollars, Notting Hill.
Notting Hill.
Oh, fuck you. That wasn't a choice, by the way. I just was curious. But that's the kind of shit that drives me nuts with Notting Hill. Alien versus Predator, Requiem, or Wanted?
Wanted.
Agreed.
Wanted's a bad movie, but it's better than anything Alien versus Predator.
Yeah. Evolution, Hitch.
Man. Because I have a soft spot for both movies in a way. But I would watch Evolution, I think, first. So I'll go that way.
I guess I have a slightly more of a soft spot for Hitch, but I'll let you one. Say Anything, The Assassin.
Say Anything.
Yeah. Octopussy, Sling Blade.
Sling Blade.
The Expendables, The Imitation Game.
Imitation Game.
Goosebumps, Irma LaDuce.
I've not seen Irma LaDuce.
Goosebumps, Arachnophobia.
Goosebumps.
Yeah, I agree. Matchstick Men, Piranha, 1978. Matchstick Men. Captain America, The Winter Soldier, Hitch.
Captain America.
Great. Source Code, Apocalypse Now.
I actually have to think about this. Source Code is really underrated. And I'm kind of like weighing the legend of Apocalypse Now more than I am the movie. Because I really like Source Code a lot. I don't know. I don't know where to go on that. What are you leaning?
I'm leaning Apocalypse Now, but maybe the legend's doing it. But sometimes that plays a role.
Yeah. Apocalypse Now.
Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Super Troopers.
Buffy. I really hate Super Troopers.
I don't hate it as much as you do, but I don't love it.
I don't
it.
Think I've seen Gamers.
Happy Gilmore, Under Siege. That's how we end it. You got to decide.
Seagal or Sandler. No!
Paul Thomas Anderson would pick Happy Gilmore.
I'm sure he would. I'm picking Under Siege.